Thank you for joining us on this journey to discover more about the English Riviera UNESCO Global Geopark, one of Earth's extraordinary places. In this series of interviews, our patron, Professor Ian Stewart, explores what it is that makes this geopark so special, from when the rocks around us were formed, to evidence of early humans, and right up to artists and writers who are being inspired by the geopark today.
So welcome everyone to the latest discussion around the English Riviera Global UNESCO Global Geopark, and in particular what we're talking about today is caves, because this particular part of the country has got quite a number of caves. It's one of the characteristics of this fantastic kind of limestone scenery that we have around here, and some of them are absolutely world famous, world leading, and that's really what we're going to be delving into today, delving into the troglodytic darkness. Really, we've got three people with us. I'll get them to introduce themselves in a second and talk a little bit about their background. But we've got Tara Beecroft, we've got Donald McFarlane, and we've got Nick Powe. And so all three have got different perspectives into this topic of the caves, really, of this area, and of caves in general, really. But Tara, tell us a little bit about yourself. How come you like caves?
So my background is I've worked at Kent's Cavern, but I'm also a caver for Devon and Cornwall, and I'm conservation officer for Devon and Cornwall Underground Council. So I think my experience is probably very hands-on in terms of getting out and about and exploring places. I've traveled and done expeditions in France and spent lots of time in exploring countless hours in caves for the last 8 years all over the UK.
I love that idea of the underground council. Does that actually exist as an underground council?
Yeah, so all cavers are represented in the UK by the British Caving Association, and each county tends to have its own council, which will kind of liaise with access agreements, how to cave safely, conservation, and how we can kind of look after these sites but make it safe. You know, it is an extreme sport, so the councils are there to kind of liaise with the local community of cavers.
I had a vision of Devon and Cornwall Council actually meeting downstairs in the caves. That's what I was going to. Donald, again, what's your perspective onto this today?
Well, I started caving in England as a teenager in the Mendips, and then Liverpool University up in the Dales. And then I was in Northern Ireland for a while, caving in what became Marble Arch Geopark some years later, and then I ended up doing a PhD in the United States, and primarily worked for a number of years on extinct mammals in caves in the West Indies. And then I've a number of research projects around the world in Asia and Africa and so on, but being interested in extinct mammals, deposits, paleoclimate issues in caves, having that English background, began a decade or more ago now, probably 15 years ago now, working in some of the caves in Britain that were primarily excavated in the 19th century and were in some cases in need of some revision in terms of putting modern dates and so on, reinterpretations. And it's hard to work on bone caves in Britain without eventually, sooner or later, coming to Kent's Cavern, because it is such a unique site.
And that kind of speleology in terms of the academic contribution has really kind of come on in leaps and bounds over the last few years, in particular around the paleoclimate, but also kind of paleoanthropology as well. And we'll come back to that. But before we do, we should introduce our last guest, Nick Powe, and particularly in your relationship to a cave that I think will dominate today's discussion, which is Kent's Cavern. Nick, tell us about your contribution.
Well, I'm not a caver, I'm not a geologist, and I'm not an archaeologist, but I happen to run Kent's Cavern, and I've been doing so for the last 20 years. It was, but it's been in my family for five generations, and my great-great-grandfather was involved in the original excavations, the Victorian excavations that took place between 1865 and 1880, And they finished actually on the 19th of June, so 140 years ago. And at that point, George Smeerden became custodian of the cave and guide, and started showing people around the caves. And so it became a show cave. And through five generations of my family, we've been running it as a show cave, trying to obviously look after it, but and also to get people to come into the environment in a safe way. And yeah, so that's what I do.
And Kent's Cavern is the showcase cave in this kind of region, isn't it? It's the one that the ordinary punters will go to get that experience. And I've done it myself. And but it is. I'd like to explore this kind of almost this culture of caves amongst, because you're coming at it from such different angles, before we get onto this kind of scientific detail of what we find at places like Kent's Cavern. But what is it about caves? It seems to me it's that, you know, that introduction to that alien underworld a little bit that people can quite happily pass most of their daily lives without thinking about it. And then suddenly they go into a cave and they're faced with this very different kind of world from the one that they're normally thinking about. Is that, anyone want to pick up on that about what it is at caves, it does it for them, or how they relate to the public?
Well, I think what's interesting is for many people that visit Kent's Cavern, it's actually their first time into a cave. Many people, because we're located in Torquay, right, the seaside resort, it's kind of the last thing you expect to find in Torquay is a cave. And everybody's here to sit on the beach, really. And but when the weather turns a bit unsettled, they suddenly decide, well, what are we going to do today? Oh, there's a cave. Let's go and visit a cave. So you get people coming here, and they've never really felt that experience of stepping into the cave. And it's this wonderful sense of going into an area something that suddenly feels quite different to anything else that you experience. Because you're stepping, in the summer, you're stepping into a cave that's 15 degrees, so it feels quite chilly. But then everything's really quiet, and quite often on a busy day here, there's a whole buzz of people outside, and as soon as you step in the cave, there's 40 of you with your guide, and suddenly it just goes completely quiet, and it's like an extraordinary transition into this wonderful environment. And then as you wander around the cave, of course, there's no wind, there's just this funny, well, this nice smell of the cave, it's a very distinctive smell as you go around, and it just feels different, and I think that's what people are interested by.
And there's that lovely moment when you turn the lights off and almost invariably someone says, oh, it's dark. And that total blackness that actually people realize, actually, we have very rarely experienced total blackness.
It's actually, it's what everybody remembers. They always, the first thing they ask me is, why is it called Kent's Cavern? That's the first question.
Why is it called Kent Cavern? We should deal with that one. Why Kent's Cavern?
Well, it used to be Kent's apostrophe cavern, so Kent's, you know, with apostrophe S. And it's probably all to do with an old English word for water going back in time. And before it was Kent's cavern, Kent's hole, Kent's copse. So it's probably something to do with that. But there was never a Mr. Kent, and it's got nothing to do with the county of Kent, of course. We're here now in Devon. So it's probably an old English word. But I wonder if it was, you know, has been... In manuscript, it's the apostrophe's been, you know, maybe it was an I before, so Kentis. But you get a lot of Kent's Bank, you know, it's quite a common name for association with water and headlands. So that's probably where it comes from.
So that's one of the things they pick up. And then the other one?
The other one is, do you still turn the question? Do you still turn the lights off? That's the second most popular question we get. Yeah, we still turn the lights off, and we do it a bit differently now. It's quite nice. We snuff out a candle, and also like a shell. Okay. It's a scallop shell that was used originally to light the caves by the people that lived here in Paleolithic times, and so that's what we do. We snuff that out, and then it goes dark, and
I'll ask Donald this in a second, but Tara, you must be fascinated by that. I mean, you're very familiar now with that alien, for the rest of us, an alien world. Tell us about your relationship with it.
I think for me, I think I probably take it to a more extreme version of what the general public experience. And I think Don will probably agree with me that we're quite a rare breed of cavers who want to go and abseil 200 metres down a waterfall just to get to these places. But I think it's one of those things where you're so remote in some of these places that there has literally been a few hundred people in this place. And I think where can else on earth really can you get to those kind of sites? And I think it it's a bug that really hits you because you're so immersed in this environment. You're so focused on the roar of the streamway, the, you know, just the beam of your light, you know, the shouts of your fellow cavers as you're moving along. And it just, it's, there's no real environment now that it just takes you away from the current world. You know, you're stripped away of all your technology, your phone's gone, you're looking at a paper map trying to navigate your way through. And I think that's why for me it's so special, because it's such a rare place to be in.
Because I mean, literally for most people, although there are these different alien environments of the atmosphere and the deep ocean and even I guess mountains, this is really one that very rarely do people ever encounter themselves. And people, I've got quite an anxiety. I mean, if you think from contemporary, or not even contemporary culture, just culture, the underworld is not generally a good place. It's where things come out to get you and bring you down, and horrible things come out. And yet, this is an environment that you've kind of made your own, Tara. I mean, is that, do people kind of look at you weirdly when you say you do all of this stuff?
Yeah, I think probably because I don't look like a caver either, I think. or a stereotypical caver, I guess, if that's what's in people's minds. The first thing people always say to me, as soon as you say to anyone, I do caving or I go underground, is the automatic response is, I hate small spaces.
Okay.
Get it back straight away. And it always makes me laugh, because some of the caves I've been in, you have to use a compass to navigate for a chamber because it's so big. You can't see the walls. So actually, the small spaces are pretty tiny and few between. And most likely, if you're going for a really horrible crawl, it's because you're going to find something quite special on the other side. But it takes a lot of mental determination, I think, as well. And I think people don't push themselves sometimes. I think that's people look at me and I go, why would you want to do that? How long have you got?
Exactly. Donald, why do you want to do that then? What was it for you?
I would just I completely agree with Tara there, but I also add that even in Britain, even in Britain, on an average year, there are probably a couple of hundred meters of new cave being discovered every year. No one has ever been into. There's just no other environment where average people can involve themselves in that kind of original exploration, even on a global scale. So it's very seductive.
It always slightly confuses me when we have this fixation with space. And, you know, there was a couple of weeks ago, the rocket, you know, went up, and these, we're sending people to the space station and these probes that go out and deeper. And yet it's all empty up there and we'll never, ever get there. I mean, actually, whereas down beneath our feet, there is this fascinating world that is very close. It is accessible, as people find it. And it's got this incredible wealth of information about our past, but also sometimes resources and things like that. And it's always slightly strange why it gets a raw deal in some respects. But maybe you quite like it that way. Is it kind of nice to have that? It sounds like a self-help group for cavers, and it's not meant to be. But do you feel you're part of a kind of small cultish group that appeal, you know, feel very familiar with caves? I mean, would you like it if suddenly the whole world wanted to go down them and start investigating? Or
a small cult.
Yeah, I think so. I think for me, the caving community is so special because it almost feels like, yes, the technology is involved in terms of lights and stuff, but it feels like the actual community itself hasn't been that much touched by time. So we have dotted around the UK little caving huts that you can go and stay in, and you walk in there and it's just so friendly, and there's no kind of technology, you just sit down by a fire and talk about your passion. And I just think, whatever sport do you have that you can have that? So it's really nice.
Well, let's talk about the caves around the Tor Bay area. We've mentioned Kent's Cavern. Nick, I mean, so Kent's Cavern isn't the only cave. And so do you want to talk us through in terms of the diversity of caves? It goes from tiny little inlets to Kent's Cavern, I guess.
Actually, there are many caves in this area. It's a limestone area. It's Devonian limestone, of course. That's the rock here, and where you get limestone, you're going to get caves. And and particularly the type of limestone that we've got here. And so there are famous caves throughout the geopark area. So over in Brixham, there's a very famous cave. And in fact, the original excavations that took place in the cave here in Kent's Cavern were motivated by what was found over in Brixham. Because the problem with Kent's Cavern is that, and this is probably the third most popular question, is when was Kent's Cavern discovered? and it's never been discovered. It's been known about for, 2,000 years, really, in terms of modern history. So we know that Roman coins were found in the cave. So 2,000 years ago, people were here. There's evidence of evidence during the Iron Age, the Bronze Age as well. So there's this fantastic sort of connection with humans. And people have been coming in and out of the caves for centuries. And because of that, when the Victorians were finding evidence of extinct animals, but what they were finding alongside these extinct animals was evidence of humans. And it was about how they could prove that the evidence of humans had not just been placed in the cave in the last 2,000 years, but it was genuinely much older than that. And this little cave in Brixham was about the 1858, 1859, when a builder was building for a row of cottages, and was punching through the back to put the foundations in, and punched into this completely sealed cave. And in this cave were the same kind of artifacts that have been found in Kent's Cavern. But nobody could use the argument to say, those have been placed there by modern people, because modern people didn't know about this cave. So there's this great story. So there are caves, and Tara, and I'm sure Don will know more about the other caves in the area that I do, but that's the sort of the social side, the social history behind caves and what they meant, and the fact that people have been using them to shelter in is what's extraordinary.
Well, we'll get on to the scientific aspects later. I mean, Tara Donald, in terms of those wider caves, and what should people could people look out for in terms of in the Torbay area?
I think it's generally categorised by three different types. So you have sea caves, which tend to be really diverse and lots of marine biology. So most of them are obviously accessible only by diving or at low tide. Then obviously you have like Kent's Cavern, the Phreatic Caves, the Solution ones, and then you have sort of quite dangerous slip rips.
You said Phreatic Caves and Solution ones. You better explain those terms, I think, to people.
Oh, I think Don should probably
Donald, Phreatic, fresh water. Yeah, but Phreatic, please, Donald.
When caves are initially forming, you can imagine a solid beds of limestone sitting beneath the water table. So when the cracks and fissures in that limestone are completely flooded with water below the water table, we would then get sort of phreatic caves forming. And then later on, as the water table, as the landscape erodes down, water table descends, the caves drain, and we get a different set of features, sort of bedose features. So that whether the passages form below the waterline or above the waterline affects the shape of the passages and just general structure.
So you tend to get kind of above the waterline, if I remember my geography, the Vadoes one, you tend to get these very keyhole caves, quite narrow, and then below the waterline they broaden out because you're getting... Is that still the way it's thought about?
Right, below the waterline we would expect the passage shapes to be oval or circular in nature as opposed to that keyhole shape that you would find above the water table.
And what's interesting about, and maybe we'll come back to this later, but I guess that it touches on this paleoclimate, how the morphology of the cave actually reflects the environment that it's found in, which might be very different. Well, it's usually very different to the environment that we now find out in. But sorry, Tara, I interrupted you. You were talking about some of the other caves in the area.
I think what's really important about and interesting about the caves in our area is they are really, really different to other areas. Like, for example, in Yorkshire, they've got these massive potholes in the middle of the dales. You go down there, there's a huge system. Whereas in the English Riviera, it's quite unique because much of the caving is so urban. You have a cave in Brixham, which is on a sort of a cliff face just underneath a block of flats. So it's quite different experience of caving, going into these places outside someone's house, where in lots of other counties in the UK, it's very remote. So I think that's kind of what's quite special. They tend to be quite challenging at times.
Challenging? Can you explain what you mean by challenging then?
A lot of the caves, you know, particularly like the ones I mentioned in Brixham, they tend to be, because the geology of the area is quite broken up, you don't have huge plateaus of limestone. So a lot of the passageways can get quite tight, or the entrances, you know, you can be doing a handstand to get into a few of them, or you can be on a quite a low, grovelly exploration crawl, as opposed to some of the bigger systems around the UK.
See, that's what would freak me out. It is that classic narrow passage.
You said it. But
I have done it, yeah. And I'm not sure I still like it. But we probably should say at this point, this juncture, about the public accessing these places. So presumably, the way you've described it, you wouldn't necessarily encourage Joe Public just to kind of squeeze into these kind of places, exploring on their own.
No, definitely not. It's, you know, we are, you know, relatively trained in what we do. I'd say if you're interested in caving, then don't do it alone. You know, go and research your local caving club, or get, you know, an outdoor sports centre to go and take you, and be safe, wear the right equipment. As a member of Cave Rescue, I don't want to come and get you. So yeah, always cave safely.
You're not drumming up business for Cave Rescue here. So. Yeah, Donald, I mean, in terms of your knowledge of this region, I mean, what are the gems? What are the standout places that you, if you were here, you know, you would be delving into?
One of the differences that we see with the caves in Devon is just relates to the last million years or so of Earth history here, in that, you know, our largest caving area in Britain is the Yorkshire Dales. But those areas were completely covered over by huge ice sheets during the various ice ages and ice advances. And that has the effect of, in some cases, eroding away shallow caves and some of the deposits and otherwise might be there. But in Devon, Devon was never overridden by those ice sheets, just sufficiently far south. And so that creates a rather different sort of long-term historical environment for those caves. And I think better preservation of the shallow parts of the caves where animal bones and things are more likely to accumulate. And so as a sort of proportion of the total number of caves in Devon, there are a relatively high number that have historically yielded really interesting archaeological and paleontological.
So let's shift into that, because, you know, I'm sure everyone listening or watching is very aware that in those earliest times, caves would have been, you know, the place to stay, to interrupt for, you know, starting that kind of human story, really, and then its interaction with the world around, and indeed culture as well. So they're kind of a repository, an archive, really, of all of these our earliest stories. Donald, could you take us through a little bit about, well, maybe the excavation? You know, as Nick was saying, there wasn't necessarily a discovery, but in terms of the earliest excavation, particularly the systematic way that people started to really look at these, Kent's Cavern, I guess, is the classic one.
Right. Well, the first excavations there were undertaken by Reverend McHenry around about 1825, and kind of sporadically and so on. And then Pengelly got involved in a much more systematic way in 1865. I think one of the paradoxes here is that in the modern world, as cavers, scientists, whatever, we're very focused on cave conservation, preservation, and so on. So the idea is to do as little damage as possible in caves. The Victorians didn't have that same sensibility. And as a result, when Pengelly began serious excavation in 1865, he was using large amounts of gunpowder. Probably over 15 years, he probably used more gunpowder than Guy Fawkes. And blasted out huge areas of rock and so on in a way that would have been totally unacceptable today. But the result of that is that we now have these amazing sections. We can see these sections that were cut down, and in an unexcavated cave elsewhere, there might be deposits in there, but we just wouldn't know about it because of all the intact material. So it's that kind of unusual situation where great damage in Victorian times actually has exposed and left in the modern cave these wonderful sections. So we can now look at the stratigraphy and the history of the cave in a way that is difficult in almost any other cave.
What was the motivation then, in the sense that, you know, they clearly weren't doing it gradually and very, very carefully? So why were they doing it in such a blunt way? What were they trying to get out?
Well, they were particularly interested in the potential co-occurrence of human remains and the remains of extinct animals, which had significance to the interpretation of the history of humans, particularly in a traditional biblical context where perhaps in earlier centuries the assumption was that these extinct animals would have been the victims of Noah's flood.
Yeah.
And then humans came along long later. Finding these things together meant that clearly that there was a much longer history of humans in the natural world. And in order to prove that, given that it was a fairly controversial idea when it was first proposed, it was necessary to show that you had unambiguous human remains or human tools, ideally human bones, alongside the bones of extinct mammoths and saber-toothed cats and so on, and then covered over with a thick layer of flowstone or stalagmite that would have sealed that unit until it was broken through by the excavators.
So am I right in saying it was really Pengelly who brings that systematic approach that replaces that previous kind of...
Precisely, because in other excavations going on, typically the cave would just be cleaned out and there would be a large collection of bones, but there would be no documentation as to where a particular bone came from within the cave. And Pengelly invented a system whereby every bone, every artifact, was numbered and could be related back to a specific place in the cave. So even today, one can go to the museum, one can look at one of Pengelly's bones, look at the field number on that bone, and we can go into Kent's Cavern, with Nick's permission there, and find out exactly, both horizontally and vertically, where that bone was when it was found.
And was that unique across the globe? I mean, is this the first place we see it happening, systematic cave archaeology?
This was the first place that system was developed.
So we should say what he found. I mean, what emerged then in terms of the archaeology there?
Well, at various vertical levels in the cave, which of course correspond to different ages, there were a wide variety of different extinct species in the more upper levels. There were hyena, saber-toothed cat, cave lion, mammoths, woolly rhinos, those kinds of animals. And then much deeper in the deposits, they had cave bears, which were actually a quite different species to the brown bears that occur much later. And then, in addition, there were quite a large number of human artifacts, stone tools and so on. And then one, of course, very famous partial tooth row of one of these ancient humans.
Well, I was going to ask Nick about that, because part of the... In the blurb for Kent's Cavern and the webpage, of course, one of the things you're very proud of is the oldest bit of human, I guess, in Britain. Is that the way?
So I'm led to believe. So this is a little jawbone that's been it was discovered in it was discovered in the 1920s, and by a subsequent excavation. So Donald's talking about McHenry starting in the 1820s, Pengelly in the Victorian 1865, 1880, and then subsequently there's been excavations going on and still today, still we have teams coming back. But this little jawbone, when it was originally discovered, they knew it was quite important. It was a little bit of upper jawbone, maxilla.
Yep.
And it had teeth that were, and one of the teeth in this jaw was loose, so they got some glue and stuck it back in, and to make sure they didn't lose the tooth. And it sat in a drawer down at Torquay Museum, It's still at Torquay Museum, which is the great thing about this jawbone. But the eventually, about the 1980s, they decided to do some radiocarbon dating on it. At that time, radiocarbon dating went back to about 34,000 years. And they were getting dates from this from that period. So it became sort of 32,000 years old based on radiocarbon dating. And then somebody thought, well, hang on a minute, maybe it's Neanderthal. Maybe it's not modern human. Maybe it's early. Yeah. Maybe it's Neanderthal. So they tried getting some DNA testing off it. And the DNA, the first DNA they got off it was fish DNA. And it was like, where did that come from? And of course, it was the glue used back in the 18.
Well, he wasn't a fisherman then, this person.
That's right. It was fish glue, exactly. And then more recently, it's been subjected to more detailed analysis. And because it was discovered back in the 1920s, actually the exact position, you know, where it was found in the stratigraphy of the finds has always been the challenging point, and what was found above, what was found below. It relied on the accuracy of the records that were kept in the 1920s, but the jawbone continues to cause controversy over whether or how old it is. We know it's pretty old. It's definitely 30,000 years old, but is it 41,000? And that's the key. And that's really interesting because that puts it into the realms of being of somebody. Who we know it's not Neanderthal. That was proved in the DNA. Eventually, they managed to find that it wasn't. Mm. But they found that they were some. Did these people actually live together?
You need to explain. You said the 41,000 is the key one. Why that age is key?
So Neanderthals in this country kind of went known to have lived to about 40,000 years ago, and so we think that and if this jawbone is 41,000 years old, and it could be older, then there is this overlap. There is this overlap with Neanderthal. So potentially early modern humans cohabitated with Neanderthals here in Kent's Cavern, and that's what intrigues people all the time.
So do you like the idea of the overlap? I mean, is that's something that in terms of whether it's true or not, I mean, whether science demonstrates it, I imagine it's a fantastic thing to be evoking, really.
It would be, wouldn't it, really remarkable to imagine two completely different species living in the cave, you know, two completely different human species. And I think we try and visualize what Neanderthals, how they made it, might have been different to us, but I think it's incredibly difficult to understand that fundamentally how these two species were so different, and the fact they potentially lived together is remarkable. And that cohabitation of two species is still to be discovered. And
I also add that Pengelly's excavations in the deepest parts of the cave there. Also yielded human stone tools, no bones, but those stone tools are very much older still. They're more than 400,000 years old. So no bones associated with those, although, you know, maybe Nick will find those bones tomorrow when he's cleaning up. We'll see.
So that's a good point then. I mean, is that how old do we think it is in terms of human occupation? Is it 400,000? I mean, potentially it can go back even beyond that because we don't have the... of the relics.
Yeah. I mean, certainly those human tools date from somewhere probably around 450,000 years ago and have slumped into the cave. So there were obviously humans, at least in the vicinity of the entrances at that time. And then,
do we know how they were living? I mean, in the sense of were these people? Were they foraging and hunting down by the shoreline and then coming back up the hill? Do we know much about life at that time in any of those horizons?
I think very little, because only the tools for the very oldest deposits, only the tools were available. During those distant glacial times, the
coast sea level was much lower, I guess,
further out, so it'd been a longer walk to pick up your seafood.
That probably means that some of the caves that are now submerged, there was probably
certainly.
Something in there that's now, you know, Paleolithic stuff that's now completely gone with the sea level rise. Nick, sorry, you were wanting to come in.
No, I was just saying that, you know, yeah, we talk about the two species, but, you know, this other species, Homo erectus, potentially, or Heidelbergensis, as they're called. Yeah. And that's three species of humans using the same space. I mean, how remarkable is that?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one site that's been, so over 500,000 years, people have been kind of, and they weren't, I don't think they were living here. I think they were using the place nomadically. I think when, yeah, you know, when the autumn came and the mammoths started heading south, then I think you'd probably follow the mammoth because it was time to head south, and then you'd come back here in the spring. But, you know, obviously, yeah, there was some kind of bush telegraph that was telling people about this amazing cave in Torquay, you know, which, you know, where you should go to because it's, you know, it sits on the, it's 50 meters above current sea level. It's got yeah, the entrance faces east, so it's protected from the prevailing southwesterly winds. So it must have been, and it's big and it's huge, you know, to stay in. So, but it's a remarkable kind of story of how, why is it that people kept coming back here to this one site, you know, and using it for so many, for 500,000 years.
As Nick said earlier, today, people often visit the cave during rainy weather and so on, pretty much probably the same 40,000 years ago. I mean, it was an equally good rain shelter 40,000 years ago as it is today. So, you know, in a sense, it's maybe, almost the same kind of motivation.
Maybe they came for the summer 2 weeks. Maybe they lived, yeah, you know, up in Yorkshire, and then for the holidays, they came down to the seaside in much the same way as people do today. I want to ask Tara about, we've talked a little bit about the kind of ancient life and ancient archaeology. But, you know, there still is an ecology in caves. I mean, there still is things that are down there, living there now. Not much, and they tend to be very distinctive. But do you get a sense of that when you go caving in terms of that ecology and life? Is that something you think about?
Yeah, definitely. I think in this area there's quite a lot of ecology, and we have some quite interesting caves, particularly near Berry Head, where you can go into a very dry cave chamber, and then right at the bottom is a seawater pool, so you have really interesting ecological life there. You have they don't sound very exciting, but they excite me. You have a species of cave shrimp which live in Kent's Cavern as well. And although we're talking about these really ancient humans, it's probably likely that these kind of species are actually the oldest inhabitants of these caves, but we don't give them much screen time. You know, these are very small species. We have species of bats as well living around lots of these areas, all of which are endangered and protected. So it's a kind of life that you don't really see when you're not in these unique environments.
It's quite fascinating, that idea of extremophiles. I know all of the kind of life on other planets, it's often caves is one of the places they go to try and get an idea of what life might be like if it's just kind of hanging on there by kind of by a thread. So so I wanted to ask about the bats, because you mentioned it in Tara, but that is one of the ones, the species that people think about in caves, and indeed the caves in this area are famous for. And Donald, this is something you've been working on extensively. So can you tell us more about the bats in the caves?
Right. So in Devon in particular, there are two species of horseshoe bats that are particularly rare in Britain, that are much more commonly found in caves of Devon, and so they're of particular interest. In fact, the studies on some of those horseshoe bats go back to 1950, some of the earliest British bat ecological studies were begun in caves in Devon. Although in a sense, bats are intermediate cave dwellers, because they're roosting in the caves during the day, or in some cases hibernating and so on. But fundamentally, they're leaving the cave to feed and so on. So there's also a whole set of typically invertebrates in British caves that spend their entire lives in the cave. So rather different sort of situation there.
But in terms of the richness, in terms of species diversity, and, you know, in particular, as Tara mentioned, endangered species, I mean, what have we got in there?
Well, Well, I think probably the Tara is probably more familiar with some of those locations than I am, but probably the greater horseshoe bats are the rarest of the bats that occur in those caves.
Tara, you obviously have got a soft spot from the way you were talking earlier on. I mean, I guess it's part and parcel of going to the cave is yeah, being with the bats.
It is, and the most special thing is actually seeing a greater horseshoe. I think I've been caving like nearly 10 years, and I think I've seen two, maybe really? Three underground. They're really quite rare. I've seen lots of little lesser horseshoes and had lots of them fly over my head. And I think we have this really strange, and it's almost like caves themselves. The public have this really strange perception, and they tend to really stereotype these two things. They stereotype caves for being scary and dark and claustrophobic, and they stereotype bats for getting in your hair, I think, and flying over you, and it, which is totally the opposite. And you know, they are much more afraid of us than we are of them. And you know, we need to look after these species and conserve them. And you know, they are endangered for a reason. And so it's a really special experience to see one. And I've had 100 bats fly over me, and none of which have got caught in my hair. it's really rare to see them and point them out. And I think that makes us quite lucky. And I think one of the messages we need to start getting across in terms of cave conservation is that actually these species won't be around much longer if we don't look after our climate and our planet and their actual habitats.
So what do you mean by that? Because, you know, in one sense, cave conservation, not many people go into caves. So what is the risk? What is the danger?
So I think, if you look at the geopark in general and lots of caves in the area, we have quite a few lost caves due to quarrying. There was obviously such a big theme in kind of our history of quarrying in these sites, and many caves were destroyed. And actually ancient sites are also under threat from, you know, the devastation of the natural environment. So, you know, it's kind of looking on that aspect. Obviously, Nick's coming from a very different conservation angle because his site gets a lot of visitors. So it's about conserving that, but also, you know, allowing people to actually experience that environment. And although people don't go caving much, it doesn't actually take that much human traffic to have an effect. And I think if you look across the world in general, it doesn't take much human traffic to have an effect on natural habitats, unfortunately. And it's something that I feel that, you know, we really need to learn from. And lots of the caves in our area have been concreted over because they didn't want school children to get near them and that kind of stuff. So it's about having a dialogue about how we can protect these sites, I think.
Donald, can I ask you about that in terms of their scientific, their intellectual archives, the importance to preserve or conserve these spaces?
Absolutely. I mean, in many cases, caves are the only repositories of scientific information on past ecology, zoology, climate, and so on, extending back, you know, over hundreds of thousands of years, because surface environments are constantly subject to erosion, and so forth. That just natural erosion, let alone, you know, human modification and so on. So these caves represent little stores or archives of a wide variety of information about the natural world, everything from severe weather events, volcanic events, changes in fauna and flora, obviously the archaeological aspects as well. All of this potentially, at any rate, preserved in these caves, but the records themselves are fairly delicate. Caves are not, a cave is a relatively small area compared to an entire hillside or gravel or whatever. So things like stalagmites that preserve those information are vulnerable to damage and loss.
And certainly, you know, from a climate point of view, so many of the really high-resolution climate records now are from caves, even down to seasonal changes in rainfall and the chemistry of the atmosphere and all the rest of it. So I can see that losing the physical landscape of the cave is almost maybe in some ways it's worse than some of the ecology that we're kind of losing there.
And it was quite interesting that when Pengelly finished his excavation in 1880, and he was acutely aware that Kent's Cavern had been visited over hundreds of years, thousands of years, just coming in for an adventure, for an explore, and he was very aware that the cave needed to be kind of protected. And that's why he made my great-great-grandfather custodian of the cave in his retirement. And then my great-grandfather came along, and then they started turning it into what is known as a show cave. So everything Tara's been talking about, wild caving, Kent's Cavern is the ultimate cave in terms of, you're going into a cave without any equipment at all. The guide leads you around, it's safe, there's paths, there's electrics in the cave. But the great thing about this cave is that it's entirely protected because come the evening, we lock the doors and there is no wild caving. Nobody can come in this cave without permission. And Don mentioned earlier on about, excavating and looking in the caves. Of course, that's very strictly controlled. In fact, this cave and the caves in Brixham have got national protection. So Kent's Cavern has got the same level of protection as Stonehenge in terms of, if you want to do anything here, you need to apply to the right bodies to do that. So I think that's our role is to balance that kind of giving people access to the cave, but also allowing the ecology to thrive. And we have a really good conservation plan. In fact, Tara is responsible for a lot of that conservation plan, and we follow that. And all our guides and all our training is about making sure that we do that. And I think that's what's nice about a show cave, and there aren't many caves in this country. There aren't many show caves that you can go into, natural caves.
Yep.
But when you do go into one, they're all different. But they're there to kind of educate and I think people leave thinking just differently about before the money went in.
So it strikes me as really important that, and I was thinking about earlier when Don was talking about, and to some extent with Tara as well, is that almost like the key role of Kent's Cavern is to give people their cave fix, to get them to appreciate this amazing environment and what it means, so that they don't start, if you like, wandering around into other caves or feeling the need to do that. That actually, it's such a fantastic educational resource, but it gives you that experiential kind of feeling in a safe and controlled and fun environment, actually.
Yeah, and also I think with Kent's Cavern in particular is it's so accessible, so you don't expect everyone to be able to go and do 8 hours of caving or lots of rope work and that kind of stuff, or have the want to, but I think what makes Kent's Cavern so important is that people who may be slightly more vulnerable or may be unable to access the underground environment are actually able to do so. And I think that's really important because it's part of our heritage and sharing this amazing human story. It's not just about going underground, it's going underground and actually appreciating our history, our human story, and being in the environment where people lived. There's nothing I think more immersive than lighting a fire or seeing a flint hand axe in the place where 100,000 years ago people actually were doing that. There's you can't get any more closer to history than that, and I think so as an educational tool it's fantastic.
I can see why you got your job, Tara. That's fantastic. And it's made me kind of want to ask the same kind of question to the other two. Donald, why caves for you? What is it? What's the last word that you would convey to people about the excitement of this world? Why are they important?
I think because to me, caves are just a unique environment that relatively few people go into. And there's just such an enormous variety of information and natural history and science that can be done in these caves, everything from pure geology to pure biology, all kinds of disciplines in between. There's just no end of interest in these structures.
So Nick, if I can ask you, I mean, in terms of the English Riviera UNESCO Global Geopark, I mean, Kent's Cavern, the caves, it must be the kind of the crown jewels that in terms of the geological offer that we have here in this region.
Well, it is. And when I took over 20 years ago, it amazed me that Kent's Cavern was just simply another tourist attraction. It was just something to do on a wet day, And yet it had this remarkable story of Devonian limestone that started its life south the equator, and traveled here, the way the caves are formed. And we needed to connect it to something special. And I think the fact that we've now got UNESCO Global Geopark status, and Kent's Cavern and other sites are all part of that. But it sort of lifts the English Riviera beyond just an English seaside resort to something of international value, of international significance. And I'm delighted that Kent's Cavern is absolutely part of that story.
And Donald, if you know, there's a tremendous history of excavation and knowledge, wisdom about this cave. I mean, if people kind of experience it, they wander through the passageways, and they might be really interested in finding a little bit more. I mean, where would you send people after they'd been into the cave in a rather maybe wet and windy Torquay day?
Well, I think one of the unique things about Kent's Cavern is that there is this 150-year record of literature on every aspect of paleontology, archaeology, geology, and so on. And that's probably unique for any show cave in Britain. And a lot of that literature is quite readily available these days through even the Kent's Cavern website itself, other websites. So there is this opportunity for almost anyone from small children on up to old people like myself. If you're interested in more details, that literature is there for you. And that's a unique aspect of Kent's Cavern.
Thanks. And Nick, final word to you. I'm sure you've got a spiel already that you give to people, but why are caves, you know, so precious, or particularly these caves?
Well, I mean, for me, it's a really unique story because I've got this remarkable family connection, which is just extraordinary, really, to think that, you know, five generations of my family have been responsible for this site. And I took over 20 years ago, and at a time when my father died, and I took over the caves, and every day in those 20 years, I learned something new about Kent's Cavern. And it's extraordinary, really, that maybe that's something to do with the timescales involved. I mean, we are talking about 400 million years, aren't we, of geology. We're talking about half a million years of human occupation and through every period of history. So maybe, but there is something every day, there's something quite extraordinary about this place. And it happens to be, you know, in a pretty nice part of the world as well. So you know, down in Devon, that just makes it quite exceptional, really.
Fantastic. Well, look, thank you, everyone, for passing on this affliction you have to the rest of us, this affliction to go underneath the surface, go delving down into subterranea and emerging with all these riches. So thank you very much for discussing it today, Donald, Tara, and Nick. Thank you.
Thank you.